There might be another way around it, and that is that we take a committee decision to ask them to relook at that 350 threshold before the implementation date. You know, that's also a possibility. But you know, my feeling is, I think we've done a few calculations. 350 is low, and we start taxing savings here. It's just sending not the correct message. So I would have been more comfortable with a threshold of 500,000, even higher. But I don't want to get to the 1st of March next year and that threshold remains at 350. I think it's going to be unfair.
So I'd like to second the Honourable Connor's proposal that be adjusted to 400.
Alfon Roy?
Yeah, I fully agree with this submission. I'm agreeing with this submission, sir, because, you know, it will be very much unfortunate for us not to apply our mind thoroughly on this matter, because the reason and argument that is currently in the discourse that members' taxation is one area that we haven't thoroughly applied our mind as legislator. And I don't think we must miss this opportunity. But my only concern, which I think Derek can help us on, what was it? What was considered for the determination of 350? Because going forward, it will be important also to come with some allocation on 400 or any other figure, you know. I think if the House can just be taken into confidence, what are the considerations made to make such a determination? Because I fully agree with the two members. Really, I mean, the fears are scary as to how it's going to impact on us, worse on the executive, you know. It's quite exorbitant.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable Van Rijn, if I can check you through the process, and bearing in mind that I'm more on the legal side, not so much the economy side, when you look at contributions towards a retirement fund, what you actually want to measure of is that your contributions will cover a certain percentage of your earnings, and that's called the replacement ratio. So if you say, for example, that at the end of your working life, you will earn a certain amount and on a yearly basis, and that you would like to have, for example, say 70% or 80% of that covered, so that when you go into your retirement, you basically have a, if you want to call it, a salary coming in from your retirement savings, and that should be to the value of, say, for example, 70% or 80% of your earnings as at that time. Now, the reason why 70% or 80% is basically also because once you retire, some of your expenses go away, your travelling expenses, etc., is less and so forth. Also, you don't have the contributions towards retirement funds anymore, so you have less expenses, and therefore still normally 70% or 80% of this is quite sufficient. Now, if you look at 70% or 80% of a certain amount, what the incentive is doing, and this is perhaps just giving you a background around how the incentive works. Normally what we do from a tax perspective is we get deductions for contributions or for expenses if people expend in the production of income. So therefore, if you've got a business and you spend because you are making money on which you will be taxed, we give you a deduction. We don't, as a rule in taxation, give you a deduction for private expenditure. Things are things like, in the past, used to be medical aid, because we want to incentivize people to take our medical aid, because that would be good for the country as a whole. And the same thing in this case is we're saying we want people to save towards retirement. Yes, it's a private expense, but we as government, we want to ensure that people have money towards that. So by foregoing the tax that we would earn on the income that you earn, if you contributed to a retirement fund, we're going to say you don't have to pay tax on that money as long as it goes towards a retirement fund. But what that does mean is that we are foregoing tax. And the question then becomes, how much are you prepared to forego? How much of a retirement pot are you prepared to incentivize as a country? If you look at our previous dispensation where we had a percentage base, Percentage-based, 15%, if I look at the retirement annuity fund contribution levels at the moment, or your threshold, it's 15% of non-retirement savings. Now, for a person who's, for example, a private business owner, they don't have a salary or anything, then their total income would be non-retirement savings. So in that case, it's 15% of everything, and there is no limit. So the feeling was initially that 15%, just having a percentage threshold is not sufficient. You need a monetary threshold, because otherwise you are, in fact, other than when we look at our progressive tax system, when you pay more tax the more you earn, and less tax the less you earn, in this case, we incentivize regardless of how much the person would earn towards the end of their life. So what we said is, we need a monetary threshold. Then the question becomes, how much are you prepared to incentivize? And the calculation was done backwards to say, this is the level of income that was not supporting to affluence, because it's the fiscus doing the supporting, and the 350,000 was seen as a leveling the playing field, because people are starting to unfortunately contribute late in life because they have not preserved. And therefore, 350 was actually fairly on the high end, as far as I understood from my economic colleagues.
This is a big issue of equity. I think, just in terms of process, the state's effect in 2015, so we can look at it next year. But let me say, this is a deep issue, because for most people, the 350, there are real equity issues. On a take-up, and yes, it has an issue on savings, because it's only higher income people tend to save more. And so on the one hand, for the lower income, as Beatrice said, this actually is very positive. But at a higher end, certainly it may be negative. Now, when we started, we had a much lower limit. If I recall, it could have been 250,000-300,000. Because this was put out 2 years ago as a limit. We had extensive discussions. Now, I think with regard to the political office bearers fund, I think that there may be some issues that we've been alerted to. And that's because of just the structure. Now, this wouldn't apply to members next year. And perhaps it's also an opportunity just to re-look at that, so it gets aligned, I think, with the pensions of everybody else, because I think it's how you classify the employee contribution as well, or the contribution that's made. So I would say, as a way forward, there are deep issues here, so it's not possible to say, yes, let's make it 400 or whatever, but let's perhaps look at this, and we can certainly introduce an amendment next year if we reach it even in the committee.
As I've said, I will take that, but if there's no agreement, I'll make a proposal that we amend it at that time. So let's work towards an agreement.
Agree on that. Okay. Can we move to plus 29? Purposes is appropriate. There is some
There are some false claims, I accept, but there are small price to pay for the incentive we provide for world-beating research and development in this country. The changes in Section 29, I'm glad the word is returned, would amend the R&D structure for tax purposes. And I don't believe we should be amending it. I believe we should not be tightening it. We should be retaining the strong incentives that we have already for research and development. And that's a very simple amendment I'm proposing. It's simply that we delete Section 29. We do not change the existing R&D tax laws. And then one resulting change would be the retrospectivity in 9.2. But let me leave the proposal. If you're dealing with Clause 29, our proposal as DA is that we delete Clause 29.
Thank you, sir. So when I look at Clause 29, Clause 29, it has got two sections, Section 1 and Section 2. And if you look at Section 1, Chair, it has got double A, double B going down. Chair, those are the contributions which came from the committee and the public hearings. And they were around the innovation. And this is what we recommended and we agreed, and we also entails the, it entails the public hearings. And as you go through down, you will find that, Chair, we also added a clause like an improve of function, and you go through down it up to 2, where we said, we give an example of the trials in medicine, and then we said, then based on that, a taxpayer carrying on research and development, which is being approved under a subsection 9, we then be able to after submitting the report, we'll be able to gain out of these clauses that we have proposed. Now, I don't understand now, Chair, that we conduct hearings, we make proposals as a committee, and we delete the whole Section 29, because it means if we want to have contributed by the committee and the public hearings, it must be deleted, we must conduct. I don't know, Chair.
Honourable Ross. Just for me to say that I think what Honourable Harris is trying to do is to refine the legislation in terms of retaining a strong incentive for research and development, and I don't think we can find any problem with regards to that. Although there was a consultative process, and we agree with the member, it's a valid point, but we're trying to refine it and get to a stronger position, and I think that's exactly perhaps the purpose of the meeting, and I would like to second his proposal in this regard.
Honourable Van Rijen, your forum. Honourable Madlami.
Yes, respond.
I respond to...
No.
When the members have spoken, if I may respond.
Okay. Honourable Van Rijen. In fact, this whole issue of tax incentives, I'm not sure as whether or not going to and backwards. But let me hear Honourable Van Rijen, because I think on your tripartite presenter.
I'm still in the same position where I was earlier on. I think my biggest problem is one doesn't have the old, or maybe the section that is what is the principal legislation. I don't know if there's a president can help us, because really to remove this whole clause without comparing with what it was before, really, in a way, it's tantamount to nullify the good work that we have done for us to be where we are. So if maybe we can get what does the original legislation say and compare it with what is being suggested, definitely that will help the process from where I sit. Thank you.
Hello. let the industry treasury after this, and then we'll legally move on.
Thanks, Chair. I hear the concerns of the members, but it's important for me to reassure them that our existing tax laws are very well written in terms of research and development. I accept that there are some false claims made, which is Treasury's argument for tightening the R&D proposal here. But what I'm arguing, Chair, is that as Parliament, we need to accept that cost in exchange for the benefits of a very generous R&D regime that actually works to incentivize R&D by firms in a context where we have extremely low research and development relative to the countries we're competing with. So the effect of Clause 29 is to tighten up the existing R&D laws. My proposal, which I am glad Honourable Ross has seconded, is that we delete Clause Section 29. The existing generous R&D provisions remain. That is a good thing for innovation, and it's a good thing for this country.
Chair, I think, you know, it's, there's certainly no attempt to narrow. I think that the issue was one of dealing with abuse. And if you look at our response document, there were changes, there was a lot of comment. We certainly took the retrospectivity into account, and we changed that date to January. But it was just far too broad, to the point where something that wasn't innovative, people were saying was innovative. So, you know, a number of amendments were made to not tighten it as much as we did in the initial version that we released. So, for example, there's issues on piloting, pilot plants and prototypes were accommodated. If you look through the response document, all of these were dealt with. Chair, and again, I mean, I don't like to use process as an issue, but I do think that, you know, to the extent that, and perhaps we need to then re-look at our process for the future, but if these comments were clearer to us, because the whole issue has been reopened, then we could have had a discussion at that point. I think at this point, as I said, these are probably most technical goals that you have. That's why you have a procedure for the way they get amended. And I would submit this is not a refinement that's been proposed. It's a major change. And it's actually undermining, I think, the approach we're taking towards abuse. So let's differentiate between abuse and what this enables. The idea is to be generous, but not to be so generous that people abuse it when they're not innovating, that they're claiming this is a tax incentive.
Chair, I think in terms of process, this committee has done everything it needs to do in terms of the Money Bills Amendment Act. We had public hearings, we had numerous concerns. We also heard people that like various proposals of the bills, we've applied our minds, and now we're deliberating on the law, and I think it's entirely appropriate to suggest that a change made in one section to tighten up the R&D laws is not something that certainly the Democratic Alliance believes we should be doing. It's not as complex as the DVD is implying. We simply remove the changes to the existing R&D laws and leave them in place. In their generosity, I agree that they are generous, but I think that that's what we need in this country to spur innovation, where it's about, as I understand, 1% of GDP, and the international standard is about 2%. So we really need to double our R&D. The price we pay for false claims is worth it in a generous incentive to boost innovation. But certainly, I don't think there's any process problem here. We're simply deliberating as a committee, as we should, on a section, and my proposal is that we don't include this section and we let the existing law remain.
Okay, I'm going to put it to the committee members now with a proposal on the 29, Clause 29 by Honourable Harris, that it be expunged. Any support for that? Okay.
I will abstain.
Okay. All right, we know that. Let's move to Section 80. Section 1.
70, 21, I'm concerned that we haven't thought through the implication if Amazon packs up and leaves
because of this tax disadvantages that they face in South Africa relative to other markets that they operate in. So while I support their position on VAT on these retailers, I think we need to do it in a coordinated multilateral way with other countries. I think imposing Clause 165, particularly 1D and E, puts us at some risk. And therefore we should tread cautiously, and Treasury should, in my opinion, go back to the drawing board and coordinate with other tax authorities so that we impose a sales tax at the same time to protect South African consumers. That would require deleting 1D and E, and it would require a small amendments in 76.2 and 78.3 when we get to them. But the bulk of what we're proposing is 165 D and E, 165 and D and E.
Member? Chairperson, I think I remember the South African section of this industry was very much in favor of this. And then I've also asked question whether other countries have done it, and then they said yes, it is being introduced. I think there's a problem with other legislation in South Africa. I don't know where it is, but you know, I can't see Amazon not doing business here. I'm intent to be in favor. I hear what he's saying, and you know, we are being isolated, and I don't want to be isolated, definitely not. But I don't see it happening. I think it's just simply impossible in terms of what's out there in space, you know, to isolate South Africa.
Honourable Van Brian?
Yes,
follow
sir.
Back,
I think this thing of avoiding being the victims of tax arbitrage mustn't be looked in isolation from the current national attempt to ensure that we have agreement with various countries on matter of taxation. That is what you call this bilateral tax agreement that we have with individual countries. And definitely, Chair, I'm of the opinion that it must be looked at in that context. But also, we can't wait for other countries to legislate for us. But we must legislate, and of course, as we proceed, we will engage with other countries on the basis of what we have at all. So I don't think, and definitely, if we still remember, I think the biggest concern that we had as a committee was the enforcement of this provision. But generally, majority, except one, if my memory serves me well, of the submissions that we get from the public hearings were in support of this measure, you know. So in that way, I don't think it's a signal of lack of confidence on us legislating around this area. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. No, Chair, I do hear what Chair Honourable Harris is saying, and it was been highlighted on our public hearings. But like what Honourable Koranoff has said, I think we'll propose that the National Treasury, you look at this, because the main concern, you remember, DPG, it was that from the stakeholders that they can't compete, the competition is bad, in that when you buy a book for 20 rand, then you sell it at 80 rand, and we suffered most were one of our own. So maybe, Chair, rather say we acknowledge this and let us give it to the National Treasury to look at it for the next other terms of Parliament.
You hear me, Chair. I'm always the first one to say this is what we heard in public hearings. Because they are very important for us to get the views of interested parties. The problem is when it comes to a matter like this, I haven't heard such an effective representation in a public hearing before as I've heard from the two women from NASPAS who were passionately arguing for this tax to be applied to their competitors. And they did make a very compelling case. But what Mark Dimini points out, the fact that their competitors are charging 18 rand for a book that they sell for 20 rand. This is a problem for Naspers. It's a benefit for South African consumers who save 2 rand on the book. Now, the problem is the South African consumers didn't come to the public hearings. That doesn't mean that the committee shouldn't consider their interests. And I think that is a much bigger group than the shareholders of Naspers, the group of South Africans that benefit from lower prices provided by large international players that have bigger scale. I'm not suggesting we should not take into account the concerns of our corporates, but at the same time mustn't neglect the concerns of our citizens who benefit from those lower prices. Now, I understand the Honourable Cornet for saying, well, Amazon just simply won't leave. I don't know, Chair. I think it's a debatable point. They might. And I didn't hear enough of a reassurance from Treasury when we discussed this in public hearings to say that we weren't going to chase all retailers and limit competition in the space to the benefit of us as and their shareholders, but perhaps to the detriment of South African consumers. So what I'm advising here is that we proceed more cautiously, that we don't make this amendment now, that Treasury goes back and reports to us on a multilateral approach to coordinate this so that we protect South African consumers.
Can I ask just one question? How do you leave cyberspace? How do you leave, you know? I know, you know, unfortunately on this instrument, suddenly I was always in the London App Store. Now I am only in the South African App Store, and I can access far less, you know, in the South African store than at a London store, but this is being dealt with through the Telecommunications Act, and soon that will be rectified, and then I will be able to go to any product of any store in the world. That is just a telecommunications problem, but I just want to know, how do you leave cyberspace? I will be able to access Amazon in cyberspace like I will access Binocular World in America and get my Swarovski at a better price than I can find in South Africa. How do you stop me from doing that? Them who may be better than me, I'm an old man, you know.
My answer, Honor Kunov, it's under Section 65E4. We've defined this as a supply of electronic services by a person from a place in export country to a recipient as a resident of the Republic. What I'm saying, so what that means is that Amazon will supply a service to someone in South Africa under the current framework. I'm concerned if we hit them with this tax, they might stop supplying that service under 165E6. They might stop delivering to South Africa. And that would be to the detriment of South African consumers. It's going to be a big competitor in this space.
Honourable Smith-Scott, welcome. But let me just make this point. I think, Honourable Harris, you have already said if we don't amend, let's proceed cautiously around this particular matter moving forward. And I think that's what we should take, National Treasury on board, or National Treasury should take on board moving forward, so that we don't deliver it on this matter further than what we've done, Honourable Members. Honourable Smith-Scott?
Thank you. My apologies for being a bit late. The prodigal son has returned. Chair, I hear the concerns from Mr. Harris, and particularly from a consumer perspective, and I think your suggestion that National Treasury should look at this is not a bad suggestion, just as far as what are the unintended consequences if one continues to make this insertion. I think that is a very key aspect, particularly in view of the impact that it might have on the consumer. So whether the decision then is whether one continues today with that amendment or not, or does one, I think that's in the hands of the committee, does one want to wait until the National Treasury gives us feedback as whether they have considered the implications of this on the consumer. But I think it is a valid concern that is being raised from the perspective of the consumer. Thank you.
Thanks, Wilson. I think, Chair, we're seconding what you were saying around let's proceed. And of course, with caution from traders. So, perhaps traders can protect us from where they're sitting of the unintended consequences. However, I'm very surprised that comment that the Honourable Harris is supporting, because in the public hearing was on the other side. And definitely we were supporting the two females who came and made the submission. But say, as is now, we need, as much as we might look at the issue of the consumers, however, we must also look at our tax base in terms of revenue collection. And this is where we at. The issue of the large scale or smaller scale, who it affects, it's something else. Where we are, we've proceeded with the public hearings, and this is the comments we are getting for treasury. And I think today we must proceed. So I'm seconding what we're saying. Thanks.
166. Honourable Ralph, Honourable Harris.
Thanks, sir.
Allowing me just to second the proposal that we said carefully. And I do believe that we were very sympathetic. I also can just make point that they had the hearings with regards to the input by the two ladies. It was a very passionate input. But you know, on the research, NOSPARIS has been doing very well lately. I'm watching the share price in that regard. Mr. Kusbecker is a very wealthy man. He's one of the wealthiest men in Africa. I'm just giving my input if I may. But This is my fourth input that the member on my right has interrupted me. This is really unacceptable. It should stop. I mean, I'm just trying to make an input. I'm a member of parliament. I'm allowed to. But I cannot be interrupted every time. I just ask the lady to be courteous. I plead you to request a member to do that.
Let's not say reduce this quality meeting to a mini house.
Yes, please.
I'm Patricia, I don't want to be like the speaker. Order the members. Order.
Please. Chairperson. The fact of the matter is it was a good presentation by those two ladies. It was a passionate plea. It made a bit of sense, but also we cannot forfeit some principles in terms of competition. And that is the basis that underlies my input with regards to that we should tread carefully on this. Thank you.
Tim, you're the last.
Simply to say, before we moved on to 166, my proposal to delete those clauses in 165 remains. I believe Honourable Ross has seconded them. So I think that if you say we should proceed with caution, that means deleting those sections.
No. They remain. I think we have noted what you've raised, and you have actually made a proposal to say if we proceed, National Treasury must do so with caution into the future. If you have a different view, I think we'll note that. We need to move on.
In terms of process, I have to insist on that. I made a proposal to the committee which Honourable Ross has seconded. If the committee doesn't go with me, then I'm fine with that, but they have to consider that proposal.
No, that's what I say. We have noted your complaint. The committee has noted that.
Sorry, Chair, that's not good enough. It needs to be formally considered by committee, Chair, like my first proposal was. I don't understand what the difference between that one
and this. What do you mean by formal consideration by the committee?
I'm making a formal proposal that we delete section 165.1(e).
I have listened, everybody has spoken, nobody is supporting that except Honourable Ross. That's all.
I don't know if that's sure.
I don't want us to go there, Honourable Harris. I'm just saying to you, we have heard what you have raised. And from what I'm sitting, it is very clear that the proposal that we are making and the earlier proposal that I thought was taking us forward, that says if there is no amendment, Treasury should actually proceed with caution. And I said Treasury will note that. And I think that's the position where we are. Agreed, Honourable Members?
So, Chair, I don't agree, Chair.
Okay, fine, we note your
proposal that we delete those clauses, Chair.
No.
And it's a seconded proposal. Surely the committee has to consider that proposal.
No. An opportunity?
Thank you, sir. I don't know when proposals, when they're made, that they are forced for committee to consider. I mean, we make a proposal, the committee has deliberated on it, and clearly it doesn't have the majority support. And where is it? There's no confusion about it. You note the issue that, look, it was conceded on the issue that there must be caution on it. I think, and then really, the committee has accommodated that. Furthermore, we can be forced as a committee that must consider deleting. So, don't agree.
Honourable Harris has called on you.
My apologies, I wasn't here when we started going through the bill. Are we at the formal point of voting on each clause? That's all I need to know, Chair.
That's where we are.
Well, then we should vote on that proposal, Chair. That's my proposal, because if, just for record sake, I think one needs to then formally vote
can
on
I
that.
Can I put it before the House, honourable members, before the committee? The proposal is that we effect change in terms of Honourable Harris' proposal on this section 1, clause 165, D and E. Yeah. Any support for that? He has raised it, supported by Honourable Ross. Any other abstention?
I'd like to abstain on this issue.
Okay. The majority have it. Okay. Recorded. 166.
I was confused.
Okay, Chair.
Can you enter me?
Sorry?
Can you enter home?
Can I what?
Can you on home?
On home. In Afrikaans, niet bij het goed.
No, it's long. John Foster, you would understand that time.
If the Justice Committee deals with these clauses regularly, and in fact now we're dealing with the Human Rights Commission with similar powers, and we've always followed the view that there must be a court order. Only in exceptional cases, when it's a warrant for search and arrest, and those exceptional cases are set out in the Criminal Procedure Act and are under A, capital B, which covers the case where an officer can, under certain circumstances, operate without a warrant. And that is set out under A, capital B, Roman 1, 2. Now, I've quickly looked at Roman 1, 2, 3, 4, and it just, one needs a really good explanation why one would need that additional power, which seems to go against the normal criminal justice processes in the Criminal Procedure Act, where you have to get a court order and then you've got certain urgent emergency circumstances where you don't have a warrant and that's under AB. So there'd have to be a very strong motivation why that power is needed to enter premises without a warrant under A capital A, and where one has the power under A capital B. Thank you for that, Chair.
Chair, look, I don't know why my colleagues from SARS are not here, because obviously they are leading on this bill. But from what I remember, this issue came up because there was a constitutional issue that cropped up. And they had to amend this, if I'm correct. I don't want to be, I'm not 100% certain. So I'm going to check with our colleagues, but I thought it was to try and deal with that issue. Obviously the powers are quite different, I think. Arnold Swart, you know, and I can't compare, I don't know the other legislation, so I don't want to pretend to be the expert. But I'm going to ask Piati maybe just to check with Kwesi Lo and come back to us on this. Yeah.
Well, let me just remind members, this is one of the areas that we're going to spend some time on.
Yeah.
We spend a lot of time on this. Honorable Van Rooyen, Advocate Jenkins, maybe before honorable members come in.
Chair, thank you very much. I'm sticking my neck out a little bit here for Treasury. Do I understand the amendment to Section 4 of the Customs and Excise Act is a result of a High Court case? I'm not sure if it's gone to the Constitutional Court, but it was the first judgment of a new judge there. I'm sorry.
It
was judgment by Owen Rogers, his first judgment, I think, in the matter of Patrick Lawrence Martin versus Gardner versus the Minister of Defence and the Commissioner of SARS. And it was about warrantless entry and searching of property and whether you can, and what properties can be searched without a warrant. They made a distinction between different properties, those which fall under the Act, sort of designated premises and the non-designated premises. Designated premises being those premises which you have declared to SARS is where you receive certain goods that you import and then do business from. And there is the whole self-regulatory issue in terms of the Customs and Excise Act. So by having declared designated property, you've basically given a bit of your right to privacy, the judge said, and in certain circumstances you can then subject yourself to a warrantless search. But the provision in the Customs and Excise Act was found to be unconstitutional. And that then has to go to the Constitutional Court for confirmation. I'm not sure whether that has gone or what the result will be. therefore I'm sticking my neck out a bit, but I've looked at the wording, because what Justice Unrighteous did, he actually set out the whole clause, he wrote the whole clause already for SARS, how it should look, in what limited circumstances can you have a warrantless search. And it is different to the Criminal Procedure Act, because a lot of the time it's not a criminal conviction that follows, but administrative penalty. So it was also done in that light. I've looked at the two provisions, the amendment and what the court has recommended. It looks like there's a lot of overlapping. It looks very similar, but I haven't actually sat down and made sure it's 100% compliant. I mean, that I feel is SARS as well, but that can be done, and I'm just trying to maybe assist SARS if they want to deal with that right now. But that's a question for me. Does that amendment, Section 4 of the Customs and Excise Act, which we are considering now, does it comply with the Gaitner decision of Owen Rogers? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Just looked on my notes. On the 11th of September, we had the feedback from National Treasury. And this, of course, was a consequence of, or maybe as a consequence of our extensive deliberation that we had on this matter before. Then there was an undertaking that these amendments that are made here, it's not the deadline, are in alignment with other relevant legislation, as it says, including, I mean, the Criminal Procedures Act. And that was what was said by National Treasury during the feedback that we received from Treasury on the 11th of September. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for the explanation. That's very helpful. And if you look on page 29 of the bill, that sets out that court case. And it seems to be, as long as I've got the assurance that the proposal by Judge Rogers is contained in this. It's a very specific amendment to deal with the finding of unconstitutionality, and I'm satisfied with the explanation. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Can we move? Honourable Harris? Omar?
Chair, I don't know if that's on justice, so I do defer to Honourable Swas' superior experience there. But I do have a concern with, what is it, 16,000. Why is that small A, big B?
Small A, big A.
Well, no, small A, big B. Small A, big A requires a warrant. It does to issue a warrant. It's the second, it's the clause underneath that is a problem for me, which defines when an officer may without a warrant. Now, Honourable Swartz is saying that that's in line with the judgment quotes within the schedule.
No, it's the other way around.
Okay.
Sorry. A, capital A, is where you can enter, you must have a magistrate, but then it says, provided in the following categories, you may enter without a warrant. Now, I had a greater concern with that Roman 1, 2, 3, 4. It was that I've never seen before. A, capital B, is a standard clause in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, where any delay, where you've got reasonable grounds, it's objectively tested by a court, it can be tested at a later stage. If you were found not to have reasonable grounds that warrant, that search would be invalid. So government officials are very careful, tax officials are very careful that they must have reasonable, and that's a standard clause. But I'm satisfied with the explanation that's given under Roman 1 to 4. It's in line with that finding of unconstitutionality, and that's what normally happens is the court then instructs Parliament and advises Parliament how to amend. And as the Jenkins has said, that is in line with what the court said. So that was my. There's nothing wrong with A capital B from the criminal justice perspective. I think you're good for that.
Okay. All right. 70? 80? 90? 20? 320? 320? 320? 420? 520? 620? 720? 820? 920? 30? last business of the day is the consideration and adoption of the committee report on the Employment Act Incentives Bill, B46-2013, clause by clause, deliberations, page 1 and 2, this kind of definitions, no, object of the Honorable Harris.
Chair, DA is proposing several amendments to this Act. I think it's about seven or eight. To help the members of the committee, I've prepared notes on what they all are so that it's perhaps less abstract. I can rely on text. May I just give this to the committee?
Honourable members? Honourable Van Rooyen?
That will be helpful, but that doesn't throw away, I mean, the normal process of considering. This is bill clause by bill clause, yeah.
I appreciate that. Of course, I'm very glad we're going to clause by clause simply to aid the members. And Chair, if I may just make a general comment, the spirit of these amendments must be seen in the context of the DA's support for this bill. Our concern is that various clauses perhaps water down the effectiveness and the power of this incentive, and everything we're setting out to do here will enhance the power, increase the number of young people that benefit from the subsidy, and I think make this an even more effective incentive to help tackle youth unemployment. So that's the spirit with which these are intended, and I hope the committee will agree that these are all proposals that will enhance the bill.
No, I'm saying, Honourable Harris, I just be patient. It's not too early. I mean, to get that undertaking from the committee. We'll undertake it clause by clause. You must just be patient.
Yeah. I think what Honourable Harris is saying is that the spirit in which they are is proposing this, taking proposal in terms of clause by clause or section by section, should be viewed within the context of the spirit of enhancing the tax incentives for youth employment, which doesn't take away the point that you are raising, Honorable Van Rooyen. Let's go page by page or text. I mean, page, how is this page's number now? Yeah. Page 4. No. Page 3.
Chair, there's an interesting aspect to this bill, and that is there's no memorandum. Now, that's not a problem, because as I understand it, it was introduced yesterday. In terms of the rules, you don't need a memorandum. But members might wonder why there's no memorandum to the bill that shows where the consultation has taken place. According to the parliamentary legal advisor, there isn't a requirement, because I found it quite strange, but there's no requirement for a memorandum that was introduced as this bill was. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Just to say to the Honourable, we will be issuing a complete explanatory memorandum with this bill, even though it's not a requirement, mostly I think because this will have to be implemented by employers, and we will be explaining it in such a way that most people can just apply it easily, because otherwise if you just leave the legislation as it is, it does make it fairly difficult. So we will be trying to do that within the next week or two, just as soon as we can. Thank you.
Okay, Honourable Harris.
Yeah, I'm not sure who can help me with this, but I have a question along the same lines to perhaps Treasury, maybe Honourable Swart, or maybe the legal advisor. But this bill was introduced yesterday. We did public hearings on a version of the bill that wasn't introduced, that is different from the version that's now for the committee. I'm pretty sure it's not a problem, but just for my own edification, it would be useful to understand the status of the public hearings. Have we, for all intents and purposes, ventilated this bill publicly? And if not, is that a problem for us?
Mama, you want to respond?
Chair, I think again we need to obviously go through the procedure to amend the Moneyball's procedure. But the way we've done it, and I don't want to, I think, Advocate Jenkins can help us there, but the way all the other tax legislation has worked, that too was only formally introduced or tabled yesterday. Both the employment tax incentive and all the TLAB bills are generally just published on a website. Then we have all those informal hearings, as you know, we take comments, etc. And then the bill gets finalized after the response document, and that's what's formally tabled. And it's tabled like that because then to amend a clause, unless it's a technical refinement, does require a whole process that the minister has to be given the change or given 14 days to comment, etc. And this is with regard to the revenue proposals, because the procedure for an appropriation bill and a procedure for a revenue bill are slightly different in terms of that act. So it's not out of line with, for example, the TLAB process. However, the times were shorter, but that's been the process has been the same.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, if I could just make sure that our budget agrees with that, then I will be happy.
Okay. Allocate.
Thank you, Chair. I think substantially there's compliance with having public hearings by having them on the draft and then effecting the amendments so that we save time. So I would agree with the Treasury on that for sure.
Right. Okay. Can we pass it on our numbers? Page 2. Page 3. Clause 1. Clause 2, illegible. Clause 3, I think I saw something that you wanted to say there. The Honourable Harris, in terms of your submission.
Thanks, Chair. Thank you for noting that. You'll see, Chair, that I'm proposing that we delete Section 3C2. If you don't mind, if I can refer back to the original policy document from National Treasury, the one from February 2011 that was distributed at the public hearing. On page 35 of that policy, it says, the design of an employment subsidy may not want to mandate training alongside the subsidy, since additional administrative burdens on employers may discourage take-up of the subsidy and reduce the number of unemployed young people gain vital work experience. So that's a sentiment in the policy that I agree with very strongly. And you'll see, the members will see under 3C2 that this clause allows the minister to prescribe such conditions that the policy advises against. The second reference is to Treasury's response document on page 5, where Treasury themselves this week said that conditionalities require act enforcement. The more conditionalities are added to the take-up, the more stringent enforcement must become and the lower the take-up. The first phase of the incentive is envisioned to be as simple as possible. So my concern with 3C2 is that it adds too many conditions. If we really want this subsidy to benefit as many young people as possible, we should delete C2. So my proposal is that we do that.
Second the proposal. Ross?
Mr. Chair, I do second the proposal.
Comment on all members?
Thank you, Chair. I think, certainly I think Honourable Harris has outlined, I think, what our approach is not to make this mandatory. And, in fact, that's the intention initially, because the training funds, for example, are from the CETAs. There's issues of aligning and so on. However, this bill is, if you asked me to write it. We could write it much better, we could whatever. But it's trying to deal with all types of concerns. So we're saying if we get our act together in a year or two, and obviously the one is to come back to Parliament and to amend it, but we're saying in the event that we can link training, there's a way of doing it, this will be done. Okay, that is the intention in spirit. We said it should probably be a matter for the second phase, but for the first phase, let's not make it an obligation. But we still put this in to say, in the event we sort our things out, the issues out in a year, then let's keep with it. Because the intention is that lots of small businesses will take this up, and they often don't have access to those funds readily. So we would certainly be undermining the effectiveness. But we also wanted to show, I think, some of the inputs made by the trade union federations. This was quite a strong point, so that it is there, and that was the reason. So it's there in the spirit of giving, of demonstrating our intention on the training issues. But it certainly will not be accepted, or I can't see this happening in the first year or two.
Chair, I understand that, but what I'm suggesting, Chair, even if we don't implement it now, even if it is done after 3 years by the Minister in regulations, the bottom line is, if this bill is really going to affect young people in their numbers, we simply cannot allow legislation to enable measures that may, and I quote the policy, discourage take-up of the subsidy and reduce the number of unemployed young people gaining vital work experience. That's all, Chair. I think in the spirit of the policy, it's not appropriate for us to add this condition. So I'm afraid I'm not convinced by the DDG's response, and my proposal remains.
Let me just try to understand. You are proposing that we delete 3C Roman figure 2.
Yes.
You read that in fact, as you read that, you read it from clause 3. An employer is eligible to receive blah, 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 blah. Eh? And is not. C under is not disqualified from receiving the incentives by the Minister of Finance in accordance with Section 5 due to displacement of an employee by virtue of Section 5.2, or by not meeting such conditions as the Minister of Finance after consultation with the Minister of Labour may prescribe by regulation, including small AA, conditions based on requirements in respect of the training of employees, and B, conditions based on the classification of trades in the most recent standard industrial classification code issued by Statistics South Africa. So what is the problem with this?
Chair, the problem with 3C2 that you've just read us,
yeah,
is that it imposes potential conditions through regulation. Now I'm arguing against conditions in line with Treasury's policy, which says that additional administrative burdens on employees may discourage take-up of the subsidy and reduce the number of unemployable young people gaining vital work experience. So I'm saying allowing the Minister to introduce these administrative burdens at some point is not in spirit of what we're trying to do here. So let's not give him that ability. I accept the DG's answer that he's not going to do it now, but why do it at any point? Why water down the power of the incentive by adding conditionalities? I don't see an argument for doing it, and hence my proposal that we delete it.
Madamini, followed by Dr. Van Roy.
Thank you, Chair. No, Chair, you know, if we then as a committee we delete what is being proposed by Honorable Harris, that is the that content of the clause that is being proposed. It's a continuation, actually, of what was said on top, because it says is not disqualified from receiving the incentive blah 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 of an employee by virtue of section 5.2, or, which is a continuation of the above, or by not meeting such conditions. Now, if we delete, then clause A, subsection C, becomes incomplete.
Amen.
I'm of the opinion that these are conditions that we are persuaded not to approve. These are exactly conditions that are meant for specific interventions around issues of training, but also around issues of biasness in terms of training patterns. So if we remove such of powers, I mean from the Minister, of course, in consultation with, after consultation with the Minister of Labour, we might find ourselves in this situation now or even in the future, because even now, I mean, if these conditions are imposed with a clear intention of ensuring that aspects of training are emphasized, because one other issue, remember, during the deliberations in the public hearings was that, you know, especially coming out from Labour, was that some of these absorptions will not result into skills transfer, you know. So from where I'm sitting, I think if we allow the Minister as well as, of course, in consultation with the Minister of Labour to do this, this will assist us when there is a provision. And definitely that I'm also not suggesting that this is something that can be applied now. But they don't know the method that we must support ourselves and establish that there is a need, a greater need of us doing it immediately as we move with the first phase of experimenting this particular legislation. So I'm suggesting that, I mean, let's leave with them. I don't see any harm in them. They will empower the ministers, of course, to of course, I mean, provide some regulation around issues of training, but also the training patterns that are followed in our country. Thank you.
Because obviously one is not comfortable to give regulatory powers to the minister, you know, any minister in terms of that. But let me say I think I can live with this one, because I think the minister will get some huge criticism if we can show up that this regulation is trying to get the benefit not to those who should have the benefit in terms of the published policies of Treasury. So maybe there's some other more important issues in this bill in front of us that we should amend. So I can live with it, but I will definitely look if the minister is not playing ball here.
So just to respond to the whip and Honourable Kernoff, I think you will note that I've taken the Treasury's own policy as my guide. I happen to agree with it, but it is expressed in the policy very clearly. Notwithstanding the fact that NEDLAC doesn't seem to agree with me, I think it's an excellent policy. And I think it's very clear. Additional administrative burdens may discourage take-up and reduce the number of unemployed young people. So the subsidy may not want to mandate training alongside the subsidy. I think we need to make sure this benefits as many people as possible, and giving the minister these powers somewhere down the line limits that. On the Honourable Kunov's points, I admire his faith in the position of the finance minister. I happen to agree that the minister we have in the post right now, we probably can trust to act in the spirit of this. But we can't legislate around individuals, Chair. We have to legislate around what, around the worst possible use of our laws by a minister. And I think if we remove this ability to regulate, we keep power in Parliament's hands, we're able to add these things if we want to legislate. But let's keep it like that. Let's not hand out these powers to allow adding conditionalities that will water down this subsidy in this clause. It's a... I'm afraid I'm not a Rasulah man, I'm convinced, and I stand by my proposal. Honourable Judy? Chavalala?
Thanks, Jefferson. Chair, one, I don't see anything wrong with section 3, Roman figure 4. Because when you look at it specifically on eligible employees, I think it's specific around the issue of consultation and ensure that there is some hegemony between the ministers, because this issue of the subsidy, it does also impact on the labor minister. So I think that as far as the issue of legislating in individuals, it's not individuals that we legislate on. It's individual given responsibility to execute specifically on a managerial part. Because you cannot just legislate and just leave it at that. There must be issue for accountability, and there must be people who do that. Now, if the issue is around adding administrative spending, that's why you have administration. If there's administration and there is issues of discomfort, or rather they will cause problems, it's something that we need to highlight. But in the main, I don't think the enemy here or the problem is in the legislation in terms of how it's written. The issue is in the application. Now, when we start to assume the issue of administrative burden, it therefore means that we are speaking on the application. Obviously, that is something that is not done. I think the principle, Chairperson, is that when we go, as we're saying, that specifically the issue of the 2 years, when you check in terms of the review, you are able to amend if there's issues of administrative burden that you've noticed through the report that comes through. So we are not there yet. We are starting with legislation. We need to start somewhere, Chairperson. So I'm saying that it's in line and it's inconsistent with also the submission that Honorable Harris is making in Section 4 to delete the entire section. I also don't understand the rationale there.
No. Can we retain yourself to 3?
Yeah, okay. No, okay, I'm fine. I thought, because it speaks to the 3 also, that 4, but I'll get to the 4 then, Chair. So I think it's proper how it's written. There's no problem about it. On the limitness of the intake, it's in the application. It's not limiting. The legislation is not saying you are limited to this number of the intake. That's not what it's saying. You're only assuming, therefore, that the registered patient will limit. So it cannot be. So I think in principle, Chair, I think it's correct.
Beatrice, do you want to say anything?
Beatrice? Thank you, Chairperson. There's something just in terms of this particular piece that we need to take into consideration. This 3C, basically, and in particular Roman 2, the conditions that the Minister of Finance may bring in here is the kind of thing that when we look at something which is experimental, and I think we did say that it's for a 3-year period, but we would like something where we can, and I don't want to because regulatory or relations and so on go through a process and there is consultation on it, etc. We specifically state there must be consultation with Minister of Labour in this regard. The reason is that because it's such a short incentive, it's a 3-year period only, if we have to wait to bring something in, that won't be next year, it will only be the year thereafter. And in this type of relations, the condition that we're speaking of here is mostly to flag. And if we were to do that, something like that, it will not be something which will be administratively cumbersome. I agree with Honourable Harris, that would be fatal to the cause here. But in the case where we find that in a particular sector, it would benefit the employees in that sector to have a specific skill, something which is actually already there that we can encourage and we can assist with, then I think we would very much like to do that. But that is, like I said, only in, like Mama said, it's only in phase 2 and much longer after we've implemented. And we can only do that after we've learned and we've worked alongside employees for quite some time. Thank you.
Sorry, honorable members, I thought we would not take too much time on this one because we really had a very robust debate in the public hearings and so on and so forth. But the underlying principle of and the spirit that the committee should continue to engage this bill is the fact that it is a first of its kind intervention. And that being the case, and the environment in which the operation of this bill is going to land is still a little bit volatile. There's sensitivities around it. And in my view, I think at this point in time, probably for the next 2 years before you do any review or assessment. You need a very tight management, the close monitoring the activity. But let the Minister of Finance forget the Minister of Labour. Because that's for me. We are in the next 2 to 3 years we'll be able to say this little baby that we put in is working in this fashion and therefore we need to strengthen it in this particular way. That doesn't say what we are proposing, Honourable Harris, is irrelevant. It is irrelevant. It is relevant, but I think for the current, in the current situation, it will be far much better. It will serve the spirit of this bill by allowing this proposal as they are, precisely because of the need to have closer monitoring. Both by ourselves and also by the Minister of Finance together in consultation with the Minister of Labour. I would want even to imagine that some of the issues that have been raised during the public hearing, they are going to continue to be discussed as we move on. It's not a perfect solution that they're putting in, and therefore there will be a number of challenges as we move on. And for me, it will be important that we allow some sort of close proximity between the implementation and the executive, particularly on the inventive side and the skills issues, as we say. If I was to appeal and probably persuade members, including yourself, on our planet, let's leave this amendment, I mean this proposal in the bill as it is.
You were very convincing, Chair, but I'm afraid in the end I believe those powers of review, which are actually incorporated in that, the Minister has to report on this scheme twice a year. Let's leave the power to impose conditionalities, which I think I would be, you know, it will take a lot to convince me that we need them, but let's leave the power with us, the legislators. Let's not provide this clause that lets the Minister do it. So I'm afraid I agree with your sentiment, but I'm suggesting we should retain that responsibility and we should therefore delete 3C2.
Okay, hello, Father.
I think the case has been made, and obviously the fear of avoiding repetition of the earlier submissions, I move that we adopt this as cited.
There's a mover for the adoption as...
I second the move, Chief.
Okay,
sorry, just for clarity, my proposal was that we amend it. Surely we need to deal with that proposal first, and then we can deal with the proposal of the clause in its entirety if my proposal does not succeed.
You know, when somebody moves in a meeting, in the middle of a deliberation for a particular position, what it means is that what has been proposed is supported, basically. And therefore there's no need to continue to deliberate on that. That's the meeting procedures. But having said that, I hear what you're saying. You see, we should leave, we should actually have, as Parliament, the ability to can do oversight on this. It's not leaving to the Minister. This bill, the way it is cut, even if we just allow it as it, it doesn't take away the powers of Parliament. At any given moment, this committee can call the Minister. You know, you don't have to actually say, let's use this power for ourselves so that we can do this. I think we should not underscore our ability to do oversight by trying to actually find our space in any piece of legislation. So, hence what I was saying to you, I think we should allow this thing or this proposal as they are, and Parliament, under this committee, must continuously monitor the implementation of the Act on a continuous basis. Agreed? All right?
I'm afraid I'm not going to go into it again, but I don't agree with you. I'm happy with the principle of giving the Minister powers. I accept C1,
forceful on the displacement issue. I'm happy to give them this pass. What I'm worried about is adding additional conditionality. And that's something, that's the reason why I still propose that deletion. Okay, on the matter of order of the committee and procedure, I believe that that proposal needs to be considered first before we consider the clause as a whole.
Okay. Well, but maybe I need to ask, and when you say it must be considered, what do you mean, practically?
Practically, it's exactly the same issue as Honourable Swartz commented on in the first bill we dealt with, where if I make a formal proposal as a member that is seconded by another member, that proposal needs to be considered by the committee before we can consider something else.
This deliberation is about, we are considering what you put on the table. So that's consideration. Deliberation is about debating the issue that you have put on the table. We have debated that. And honourable members are saying they propose that we leave this thing as it is. In other words, they don't agree with your proposal. And that's where we are. It has been moved as a government.
Sorry, I've made a proposal. I believe that I have the support of more members on this committee than you think.
No. I am not getting that. And that will come when I make a ruling. It's not for you to have got more members on my side. I don't know where you see them. You don't see them. From where I'm sitting, I don't see that. I'm saying we have deliberated on this matter. There is a proposal that we leave this amendment as it is. There's a mover, there's a second. Is there any objection?
Chair, sorry, on a point of order, I'm afraid this is rather serious. Chair, my proposal was put to you first, put to the committee first, with a seconder, to formally propose an amendment to a session. I'm happy if the committee doesn't agree with me to drop it. I'm very happy. But I don't believe that's been tested, so I don't think we can proceed on...
Can I put your proposal before the committee?
Yes, sir. I would appreciate it.
Okay. Is there a proposal on that? Honourable members, any supporter? So where are the others? Honourable Harris?
Chairperson, just an important... It doesn't matter whether there's other supporters. I think if there is a proposal, you have to put it. I think that's the point he's making. And if you do that, we could have saved 7 minutes.
Okay. All right. Point taken? Okay. Well, in terms of what I put it before the committee, the proposal doesn't go through. It has not been supported.
Thank you, Chair. Can we just record the dissent of the
chair? Thank you. We'll do that. Section 4. Your proposal?
Chair, thanks. I'm happy for other members to come in first, but if I'm the only one with a proposal, I propose we delete the whole of Section 4. What Section 4 does, Chair, is essentially establishes a sub-minimum for sectors where there aren't sectoral determinations or a bargaining council agreement. So the members might have heard me talk about how this version leaves out entry-level part-time workers in sectors such as that. It means that people who earn very little, who most need the support of the state, will not be subsidized. That's the effect of this section 4. It's, if I may just quickly refer to the policy on this, which establishes in the original policy the argument on page 17 that the minimum wage is not an explanation for the lower productivity of younger workers. And on page 39 of the policy, the actual proposal, the original proposal from 2011, suggests that the subsidy should kick in effectively from zero, no matter what, no matter how poorly, which sector you're in, no matter whether you're a part-time worker or not, no matter whether you're entry-level or not, you will still be subsidized. That was a better version than this, simply because of the existence of Section 4. And deleting Section 4, we remove that sub-minimum, and we extend benefits to temporary workers, to interns, to entry-level workers, to every young person who needs the help. So, Chair, my formal proposal is to delete the whole of Section 4.
Honourable Van Rijn.
The Reverend meeting held to Commissioner Treasurer when he stepped back on this matter was adequately addressed, and the emphasis was placed on the determination of
minimum wages is done by the Department of Labor from time to time. An example is made. I don't know if there's an intern who ends to 2000, an intern. So obviously, Chair, if we legislate as we do now, let's also not forget what is happening in the bigger space, because we can't regulate in a way that we will encourage, I mean, what do you call slavery wages, you know? But going below 2000, in that sense, we are accepting that there are people who are skating below what we are regulating. So as a result, I really don't make sense of this particular request.
I was under the impression it also has a huge bearing on the temporary workers, which is an important sector in the constituency, and I support the proposal from Honourable Harris.
Can I ask, obviously one would like this to see as broad as possible, not to have people who must benefit cannot benefit because of that. So I really would like to listen to the explanation of Treasury. Will it be legal to scrap this clause? You know, is there any legal problem not to do it? And then secondly, the only problem I do have with it is I hear when it's temporary workers or part-time workers, but I think it will be unfair if I'm not paying the minimum wage as an employer, and then I join the incentive. I don't think that's fair. I can definitely not argue for that. But is there a way around it?
Before Treasury, just clarify the matter. If there's a minimum wage in the sector, if there's a sectoral determinant or a bargaining council agreement, that is the minimum wage. Nobody's suggesting that people mustn't be paid that. The bill recognises that, and the DA supports that 100%. The problem is, Chair, if I can explain to Honourable Cooner, if you're in a sector that doesn't have a minimum wage, a bargaining council, no sectoral determination, say, community and social services, and you are a part-time worker, a temp worker, a shift worker, and you happen to work a little bit in a month, and your salary for the small amount of work you do adds up to less than 2,000 a month, you are unsubsidized because of those four. It introduces a 2,000 rand sub-minimum, which makes those people who work for a couple of hours a month unsubsidized. And that's a problem. It's significantly weakens the bill here. I don't think we should leave anybody out. I think the original proposal in Treasury's policy suggested that all young workers below this age should get subsidized, and I think that's something we should stick to, and so I still believe in Mr. Leeds' section ball.
I think the concern has been dealt with. We did, so it does cover the people that Honourable Harris fears, like the part-time workers, as long as in a proportionate sense it's 2,000. So if they work half a month, then 1,000 is okay. But let me actually just point out the provisions.
Thank you, Chair. Just in relation to the part-time workers, firstly, all temporary workers and part-time workers, nobody is excluded from this. But what we've done here is there's two kind of basic things that needs to be taken into account. Like Mama says, if a person works for part-time, so say you work for one day out of a month, then your proportion out of how many work days you would have worked if you had worked with that employer the entire month, say there were 22 work days, and you worked only one day, then it will be 1 over 22 of 2,000. That is then the level. So it is in fact like that. So it addresses exactly Honourable Harris's concern about what happens is 2,004 per month only, irrespective of how many days you work. No, it is 2,000 in respect of a particular working day. We did not specifically go to that down to the level of hours, because at the moment we go into hours, wouldn't have seen it anywhere else in the bill. We did consider it. It makes it enormously onerous, particularly when you look at people who do shift work, and then if you look from a payroll perspective, this becomes totally unmanageable. So we have done it in terms of dates. Then your second thing is, if there's a particular area where employees have already actually kind of agreed with the employer that there's a basic minimum level that must be paid. There is nothing preventing them from having a plant agreement with a particular employer, in which case then it becomes a binding agreement, and then that level, if that is below 2,000, is also then legislated for, as long as that is then a binding agreement between the employer and the employees. So if an employee, for example, say a group of employees feels that in our particular industry, we are satisfied with, I cannot imagine it, but yes, we are satisfied with 1,800 Rand, and we want to ensure that we also benefit from this and future employees benefit, they can enter into a plant agreement and immediately it's covered. So then you wouldn't have a 2,000 limit. The 2,000 is there for people who do not have that kind of bargaining power. It's just so at least the employer has to pay that level of income in order to get the incentive. Because I think the point is well taken that we don't want to incentivize people who pay below minimum wage, but because you have such different levels of minimum wage between different industries and even within the same industry within different levels of dots, this was felt to be an appropriate average. Thank you very much.
Others? I accept all of those points, but it still introduces an artificial sub-minimum. A worker who isn't able to negotiate such a plant-level arrangement, who finds himself in a situation where they, for whatever reason, are not achieving the sub-minimum, will not be subsidized. I think it reduces the power of the incentive, and I stand by my position that Clause 4, Section 4, does not add to the bill and should be deleted.
Alf on Palmer.
Yeah, Chair, all concerned submissions noted, but the rest of the matter is that it can be drafted, maybe it can be better. But the rest of the matter is that we are experimenting here. So broadening it might also be a problem. If we all agree that we are in the laboratory here, broadening it might also be a problem. So I will insist that let's speak to these provisions and obviously as a committee and as the public, let's observe how they work out. Thank you.
Okay. Honourable members, one of the things that I learned in the last meeting is that if we had scheduled a meeting from 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock, we should finish on time. So I would want us to move as quickly as possible because based on that, travel arrangements are also made. Yeah. Now, if one is to follow the normal process, I think Honorable Harris has put forward his argument for clause 4 to be expunged, and we have entertained that, and I want to check if there's any support for that. Okay. Counter proposer? Supported by you? That's an objection. Okay, fine. Honorable Harris?
Checking. And you note the objection of the DA.
Yeah, noted that. Clause 5. Any amendments? No. Clause 6. Honorable Harris?
It's like you can read my mind, Chair.
Who?
Sorry, I'm just, I just need to double check my, yes. It's just simply a typographical error, I think. The 6A1, at the end of 6A1, should be a word or.
Okay, Victor.
Thank you, Chairperson. The drafting convention basically works that if you've got a list and there should be an or between all the different parts of the list, then the or is only between the one before last and the last, the same with and. So unless there's an and and an or, then you would have it between both provisions, but in this case it follows at the end of the list. So that would be correct according to draft convention. Thank you.
I see no reason to doubt that. Can I just double check with the legal advisor?
No, that's correct.
That's what
yes, that's treasury indicated.
Okay. Any other?
I just wanted to check that implied that legal advice is not going to be tested outside. Is that the correct advice?
There's been clear in this consensus around that. Any other? We're still under Section 6?
Yeah.
Honourable Harris. Thanks, Chair. I took a look at the Refugees Act, and I think, if I'm correct, that the second reference to Section 22 of the Refugees Act should refer to the first reference should refer to 22.1. So under 6B2, issued to that employee in terms of Section 21.1 of the Refugees Act, I believe that that is Section 22.1, which deals with asylum seeker permits. That's correct. Then Section, application for the permit in terms of Section 22.1, the application for asylum section is actually Section 21.1.
Mr. Jefferson, thank you, Honourable Harris, that's absolutely correct. And this is our first amendment that we've got then for next year. If you were there with us, then we will make that amendment as soon as we can. Luckily, because it's a technical amendment, we can do that. We can, well.
In terms of that, Advocate Jenkinson come in, I think in terms of Chair, that the Money Flows Act, I think this change can be made because it's a correction. And the department is certainly supporting.
Well, Chair, I just wanted to understand the process. I didn't quite understand, and I accept what you said on this issue, and I fully support that, but you indicated that if one amends any other section, it then has to go back to the minister. There's a lengthy process, and I think this is very important when one considers Mr. Hess's objections. Should we agree to one of his suggestions? What the impact would that be as far as the passing of the bill? I didn't quite understand, because normal, this is a Money Bills Act, I appreciate that, but it's different from other legislation. The process of amending is more technical. It has to go back in the time period, as I understand it. The minister then has to look at it. And would the implications of that be that one can't pass that bill this year? I think that's a very important consideration. Because some of the arguments that are made have got a lot of are compelling, I must say, but in the back of my head I'm keeping being reminded of what was said about the process, and we might in fact delay the passing of the bill. I was betwixt in between on the last section, 4, whether I should support it or not, but I'm thinking, what would the implication be for the passing of the bill? We know that Parliament has got to find out everything very quickly. I'd like to hear from Mr. Mamunia. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. The specific amendment, the second reference to Section 22.1, it should be 22.1.1. This is the application, it's not the issue. That will go through, in my view, as a correction. It can be done in two ways. The minister can do it, or a member. I think the Money Bills Amendment procedure says the minister may do it on the floor of the House in terms of the rules of Parliament. That would be amendments proposed by the Minister, Section 4. A House or committee may consider an amendment to a money bill proposed by the Minister in order to make technical corrections to the bill. Now, technical correction means it doesn't change the meaning and the impact of the bill, which I would go with. That's the one option. The other option is to follow the procedure as set out in Section 11 of the Money Bills Procedure Act. I think it's in Section 11, passing a revenue bill. If I may say, two broad issues there. One is the consultation of the Minister of Finance, which he must give at least 14 days to respond, but the Minister can choose to respond in a shorter period of time. But it must be given at least 14 days by this committee, and then that comment must be included in the report. The other part is the substantive part, which I don't think will apply to this specific amendment, and that is, if we want to change anything in a revenue bill, you must ensure that the compliance with the fiscal framework and that there's appropriate balance in terms of certain tax proposals and whether there's service delivery impact and so forth. But this being more technical amendment, I don't think that will come into play. So there's a time frame, but it doesn't have to be extraordinarily cumbersome on the process to pass the legislation in time as envisaged in the bill itself. Thanks, Chair.
Still
on
to comment.
Let's not say
that. You're fine. Okay. Let's go.
The legal advisor gave us some options there. I think as a committee we need to decide which one we're going to pursue.
is the proposal? Judy?
Chair, I thought, look, as a committee, we are considering this legislation, however, we can make correction. And in the spirit of changing the 122, it was on the issue of just making a technical correction. And I don't see anything wrong. But if you want to make it technical itself, as far as the process now, Chair, then it means you would go with the first thing that advocates suggest around the issue of amendments, taking it to the minister. The minister can make technical correction in the House on the bill itself. But really, there's a correction. That's why when Honorable Health speaks, he's making submissions to the committee to consider. Where those ones are not met, those ones you can always agree with. So I thought it's just a correction, Chair, and the committee can do that. Thanks.
Okay, honourable members. Yes. Honourable Steve, you want to say something?
Okay, this is, one must do this as quickly as 6-1. If anyone, that's a technical change. We should do that with the quickest process. But my broader concern is if we have more substantive amendments, what would the impact of that be? Would we be able to pass the bill in this time?
And so far we haven't had substantive amendments. So far.
Okay.
So far.
Okay.
So I think whatever amendments will be made is either technical one that are there, which can be done by ministers on the floor in terms of what we are saying. Can we move on, honourable members?
Thank you.
Arif?
Confirm. We're deciding as a committee that we agree on this technical change. And am I correct in saying the minister will propose the change from the floor of the House when we debate the bill? Is that the decision?
Speak to the informant who speaks so that I can hear exactly what you say.
We're trying to listen to the advocate, and I think that's what he proposed as the first option. I see Treasury officials nodding. To me, that sounds reasonable. I just think we need to decide, because it does need to change using either of the mechanisms that the advocates described.
Judy?
Okay, maybe me was confused now. I mean, we're a committee. We are considering the legislation. So I think we are in the right to make a correction, especially of technically, besides doing that process that advocated that issue. That's why we are here, and that's the reason we're here. We're not making an amendment in a manner where legislation was amended, now you've agreed on. Now you are dealing with the legislation itself. What is that technically? I don't see a problem. We're in agreement. Let's just change the number.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Honourable members, I think so far we have not dealt with any substantive matter in the bill. Now, the Act provides, money bill provides on how the minister should respond on these issues. So if they are technical nature, advocate Jenkins has given us an understanding of what the minister can and cannot do. This committee cannot dictate to him on how he's going to respond on those issues. So I think let's proceed with our work. And the minister will then, either if any change which is substantive, which I doubt is going to be, then it will be dealt in that particular process. Bearing in mind that all of us have committed ourselves to say we need this bill to work. Okay. Honourable members, can we proceed?
Sorry,
John,
I'm sorry to be a stick on this. There's no defense on the fact that this needs to change. I don't understand how this committee can make that happen. Perhaps someone from Treasury can advise what's going to happen next. Given that this committee agrees wholeheartedly that there's a technical amendment that needs to be made, I don't think we can simply just move off and say, well, we hope the minister corrects this in the debate. I think we actually need to resolve something.
How do you intend to resolve it?
Well, maybe our legal advisor
tell us. We report to the minister, the portfolio committee, in our report to Parliament, and we give the minister notice of that. He said, here is an amendment, and we would, in terms of the Money Bill Act, we would ask you to move from, and it's purely reporting to the executive, as we normally do. He then moves it so that we bring it to his attention formally. It's one sentence part of our report.
Agreed?
Yes.
Okay, fine. Can we move? Do you still have any amendment under 6?
Well, thank you, Mr. Harris, for picking up this.
Yes, thank you. Chair, under Section 6E, Again, Chair, I'm going to go to my Bible on matters of wage subsidies, which is Treasury's policy document from 2011, where they argue in their original design that young workers who are already employed should be eligible for the subsidy. Now, Chair, I think there's a lot of logic behind designing a subsidy like that. I think, first and foremost, if you do talk about matters of substitution, which the trade unions are concerned with, I have argued that they should not be too concerned because of various economic factors, but now also because of the anti-substitution clauses in the legislation. But nevertheless, by far the most vulnerable group to substitution, by far, are existing young workers. Older workers who've worked in a workplace, they have traction, they have networks. It's if you combine those networks and that traction with the anti-substitution measures, plus the economic arguments, there really is no danger of substitution. But when you deal with young workers who are new in a workplace, not subsidizing those existing workers is a major problem for them, I think. It leaves them very vulnerable. So the design in the policy that young workers who are already employed should be eligible for the subsidy is, I think, an approach we should take with this bill. And in order to do that, we simply need to delete Section 6E. So that's my formal proposal to the committee. Well, I made quickly.
Thank you, Chair. Now, I do understand what the Honourable is saying, but if I were to take back the Honourable to the preamble statement of this bill, then we are contradicting what he is saying, because it says since the unemployment rate in the Republic of South Africa of concern to government. Now, those people are already employed. The bill is designed to make sure that there is an instrument to deal with the unemployed. So that is why we cannot delete the clause E as proposed by the Honourable Member. Thank you, Chair.
Look, this submission, Honourable Harris, I think it might further erode our taxes, because if you check the provision of this amendment, it implies we gonna obviously people will be compensated on the basis of what is this and pay as you earn. So really, from our side, we really need to be very, 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 very cautious. If we are ready to extend it to cover those people who were employed, I mean, some time ago, I mean, the erosion will be a bit deeper. Can't we, I will still go back to that argument of, can't we just restrict it to an exercise of an experiment where just this few sample, I mean, is targeted? Because we open it up, that definitely. I'm very sure that the ramification in terms of our revenue might also be an issue. Thank you, Chair.
Judith?
Thanks, Chair. I think, I mean, the spirit of this witness has covered me. However, it must be clear that, Chair, we're dealing with new entrants into the market that are eligible in order for companies, for instance, for companies to access the tax incentives. This is in line with the entry level focus of the incentive itself as far as objectivity is concerned. So I'm moving, Chair, that we leave it as is and we move to and we note if there's any dissent, whatever. But in the main, Chair, I don't see us only deliberating and wasting the time.
Others? The last one? Chair, I don't quite know what to say to you, Judith, because I didn't... Honourable Judith, sorry. But to Honourable Zubedana and the Whip, the reason why I am proposing the deletion of the section is that those young workers who we agree are, I think, relatively vulnerable in the workplace may find themselves unemployed because of the subsidy if it only applies to new workers. So if we're trying to tackle unemployment,
What I'm arguing is it's worth accepting a bigger deadweight cost to remove entirely the incentive for those young vulnerable workers to be replaced. And on the matter of that deadweight cost, which is the matter that the WIP raised, the revenue effect, the original proposal, which did include subsidy for existing workers, estimated that the cost per job was 37,000 rand. So that's extraordinarily good value compared to other incentives that this government provides. The next loss is, as I understand, the expanded public works, which is 60,000 rand per job, and the GBSS jobs fund, which is the same price. The IEZs cost 160,000 rand per job, and the automotive subsidies are around 200,000 rand. So it's extremely good value, even when you subsidize existing young workers, at a cost of 37,000 rand per job. I think that's a cost that this committee can, with a lot of confidence, commit our fiscus to.
Thanks, Thomas. We want to, okay, shortly. Let me turn left.
Yeah, that's very good, Shay. No, Shay, I think, yeah, maybe.
I was saying, I hope I heard you correctly, Honorable Harris, when you said this will compromise or maybe make those vulnerable young people who are currently employed to lose their jobs because of the incentive. But then if that's the case, it's provided for here. I mean, no one is expected to lose the job because of the introduction of this incentive. There is a penalty clause incentive here to deal with that. And it obviously can't only be about young people. If that's a concern, it must also be about all people who are already in employment now. You know, so I think we really need to focus on the provision that are made here to counter this abuse, you know.
Okay. Chairperson,
I must support Honorable House, you know, to widen the net. But I think it will be probably fair. The first document was published in October 2011, I think. You know, I will support 2013 to become 2011. I think that will be fair, fairer than it is standing now.
So you support 20?
You know, the cut-off date is 1 October 2030. It should be, I think, 1 October 2011.
Date?
Oh,
okay, change it.
Otherwise, okay. When it was published and the indication given by Treasury and the government when they want to do it, now suddenly they move it on 2 years later. I think it should be 1 October 2011.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a type in here that it's a technical amendment. It should be 2011, Chair. Pretty easy to pass it. But I support the assessment. I think, Chair, that's one way of looking at it, just to make it a bit broader, and it is only a technical amendment.
No, just a moment. Momo, quickly.
Chair, I think this would, with due respect, not be a technical amendment, since it does have consequences from the fiscus. I think that there are good points that are raised, but I do think that, look, this is experimental. When we published the book, we made the date just around the time we published it, or immediately after, so that at least the impact of this bill doesn't stop employment in the 3 months or so before it actually takes effect. So it is covering existing, and as I said, you know, in this bill, we've really tried to, even where there's been disagreement, deal with issues like displacement, deal with issues of deadweight losses, and this would be a deadweight loss in a sense. That I mean. So I would say, you know, it would be, may not be the most fairest way, but, and I mean, that issue always comes up, but I think we are broadly in principle trying to be fair from the time we published the legislation, and I would just appeal that we stick to it. It is experimental, I think, and look at all the other issues. But it is a judgment call. But the judgment call would be a substantial, well, will not be a technical amendment.
Thank you.
Honorable Ross. Citizen, yes, I share the concern of unintended consequences. You know, it's such a small paragraph, but such huge implications, perhaps. Because if you have a business and you employ, you have a few young people employed, and now you have a subsidy, you employ, say, another five. Five is employed, you take in as a new five. They are then subsidized, and that puts you in a better position in terms of your finances, in terms of your expenses, with the newly employed than the older. You know, I don't want people to be prejudiced. I'm taking it a bit wide, but this is the practical implication. And this small sentence, I'm really concerned that we might move into this unintended consequences. And I would like to make proposals here, because this needs, we've been thinking about this for a long time, but you can clearly see this is a problem, and I think it needs to be addressed. And I share the concern of Honourable Harrison. I would like to second him in his proposal. But we can look at the other proposals, and it's good that we have a couple of lawyers that can bring up some technical amendment here. But certainly we have to look at this, and the unintended consequences in this could be vast.
Honourable members, I think we have deliberated on this matter. Clearly, we are trying to close all the loopholes of unintended consequence or abuse. And this abuse is not only about young workers. It's about displacement. The argument that they are putting is about displacement of both young and old. Now, the internal mechanisms that they have been stipulated and agreed to, in fact not agreed to, or indicated within the legislation to ameliorate the chances that employers may actually abuse the system is there. It may not be adequate, but for us to open it up to say all young people, new entrants and existing ones in employment, is going to be a bit problematic. Now, I think we have deliberated on this matter, Honorable Harris. You have put forward a proposal in terms of the amendments, and I want to check if there's any, after this lengthy deliberation, is there any support of this the deletion of what you are proposing or addition?
Just add a footnote to the proposal. I agree we should put it to the committee, but can I just say that there's very few decisions that this committee takes that affects more than a million young people in one decision. We're talking here about a proposal that would probably mean that around more than a million young people would not be supported in their employment if this committee does not delete that law.
Yeah. You know, I'm just trying to think. I don't know how many of us are employers. I'm just trying to think. How would an employer consciously begin to do this? You know, the mechanisms are there to deal with abuse. Let me just put it that way. Can I then say, Honourable Members, we have deliberated on this. Honourable Harris has actually argued very strongly for his case, but but I'm saying let's test it in terms of putting it before the committee whether we should accept this amendment or not to support that. All right, fine. I can see that.
I support my proposal of 2011, 2 years later. That's fair.
Okay. Honourable.
It changed the context of this data submission. Then that's another proposal. So obviously, we never interchange that.
Yeah. I'm just saying that for the record. For the record. Okay. On the side of those who have actually not supported the proposed amendments, is that clear? You have it. Can we move to... We note your objection. We'll hear that as we move on. We are now on clause 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, clause 12.
Sorry, I actually have a question, if I may, on clause 9.
All right. Run over amount.
I would like an explanation from Treasury on the mechanics of subsection 4 under section 9. I'm trying to understand how this section works in the context of a company that runs out of PAYE to claim back.
Thank you, Jefferson. Basically what it means is that if you've got an employer who's currently registered for employee tax purposes, their incentive exceeds the employee tax on a month-on-month basis. That means they will roll over the incentive that they could not claim to next month. However, if you look at the cutoff of 6,000 Rand, that will apply over a six-month period. So that means it's the highest amount that you can get for an employee in the first year. So that means even if you got 1,000 Rand per employee, you will only be limited to that. So it's designed not to cut off people who roll over and you've got employee tax, because presumably what will happen is you will go up in terms of your employment, you will have one person next month or 3 months later, you will have two, etc., especially with the incentive. So it's not envisaged that you would go down, you would go up in terms of employment. So it will not cut you off. So effectively the rollover is only effective in respect of people who are not tax compliant. So for example, if you were to not claim, not due to the fact that you don't have sufficient employee tax, but because you were not tax compliant, at some point this is going to start to bite you. But it will not bite you if you are a normal tax compliant employer who just doesn't have sufficient employee tax to set off against. Thank you.
That's my proposal too. I believe you could call this a sunset clause. And Chair, I don't believe that we should have one. I think the committee has the right to at any stage review a piece of legislation, and I think given that we're being reported on this intervention twice a year, we will have ample time to make that decision, and that discretion should be left in our hands, we should not codify it in the law to trigger an automatic sunset clause. Let's leave that up to us and take out the sunset clause.
I shall support
I've never read something. We almost are putting in here that we are going to repeal this bill in 3 years' time. We don't know what's going to happen in 3 years' time. I don't like this clause 12J.
And employment not receive the employment tax incentive after 1 year.
In other words, the act is repealed in 3 years' time. That's what's going. That's in effect what we're saying. We're saying to the next parliament that you, in fact, this is automatically going to lapse. So I'd like to voice my objection to that.
I think I'm afraid, but let me just allow members.
Thank you, Chair. No, Chair, I'm a bit confused there, because as the committee we agreed that this is an experimental instrument. Now, if it is an experimental instrument, you don't know the outcomes, you don't know what is going to happen. So it would be very dangerous not to table the time frame as to when the effectiveness of this instrument must be terminated. It can go on and on and on and on, irrespective of the outcome. So I am saying, let us leave the 2017, because we have agreed that it's an experimental instrument. And then based on our oversight, we will be performing and doing recommendations, looking forward though that by the 2017 it should be terminated or it should be repealed. That's what I'm proposing. Thank you, Jack.
Honourable Gordon, say this experiment works fantastically, it will be very unwise to stop it in 2017. But we are stopping it then. So it's unfair. I think it's just a stupid thing.
Momo?
Members will recall, what we said was there will be a review done after 2 years, so well before the 2017. I have a lot of sympathy. I think the intention is to make this longer, and that's what we say in our response document. And like Honourable Kurnoff has said, I think it will be hard even for government to stop it if it's actually working well. I mean, in this bill, just bear in mind, we had to deal with some of the trade union federations to say there's abuse. They've even worried about how much this will cost. So we had to say we put a limit on the amount so that people... isn't a future commitment on the fiscus. But frankly, think some of us in this will work so well that in fact the demand will be to expand on it. And that's where we are. So I don't think we differ in spirit here. I think it's just trying to deal with all the comments that we receive on bill of having some sort of limit.
Right? Fine.
But I think there's confluence on this one.
Okay. Honourable Harris, you'd like to do with it?
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm remain unconvinced, Chair. It's just not... I don't think it's good legislating for us to apply a sunset clause on the next Parliament, as Honourable Swart says. This committee has ample chance to review the Act, and let's do that when we think it needs to be reviewed, not at some date, some arbitrary date in the future.
I thought confluence means convergence.
Yeah, right. Chair, may I just
clarify first. Confluence means convergence. So you are not different. So ours, yeah.
May I'm constrained to be saying confluence with what Mama said, but I'm simply a house sentiment on the matter. I think Honourable Duvazana, I mean, she's supporting the submission that has been made, you know?
Honourable Harris. So I have got a problem with agreeing with you, Honourable Harris.
Okay. I don't think there's issues here.
The practical concern is Parliament does not sit. Parliament sits normally until the end, middle of November of a year. This automatically ceases on the 1st of January of that year. Parliament doesn't even sit in that period, Jay. We've had, so that is my problem. We're going to have to pass a legislative instrument in 2016 to prevent the automatic cessation of this incentive. And that, to me, is not a way to legislate. You will rather amend it in that year if it is not working. That is the way you do. You don't say this Act will stop at a time when Parliament is not even sitting to consider that. The 1st of January is at the beginning of a year. It's a very strange date as well. But see, I don't want to deliberate. I just want to express my objection.
I think I agree with you. On this one, we agree. Because if from the inside, Momo, we are saying this tax incentives for 3 years. It will be reviewed in 2 years' time. At the same time, we come back that no employer would ever get tax incentive from the 1st of January 2017. I think that we can live without in the bill. The 2017. It's repetitive. I think the evaluation, the monitoring will determine the particular period, how far we can, how far we don't go. So, let us leave it. When I say leave it, I mean you must expand.
My question is only the practical implications of this, because this might be a substantive amendment now, which has an implication for consulting the minister on that.
So what do you propose?
Well, we'll have to go through that process of consulting.
It's not technical, this one.
This is a substantial amendment. One can probably... But he doesn't have to wait 14 days. He can come back quickly because we want to pass this bill as quickly as possible. I think we have a broad agreement with that. But we just need to bear in mind that there is a practical implication.
Yes, sir. I think, sir, we're confluent. We're confluencing in this one. The same process that we did that amendment, I think, was good to follow the recommendations of the committee to the minister to remove this issue of 2017.
Momo?
Chair, I'm only worried, I think, on what Honourable Swart has raised, that will this not have the impact of delaying the bill? So I don't know if Advocate Jenkins can help us. If there's no way you can say this is not substantial. So here's an issue. I don't think there'll be a principal objection from the Treasury, but I can try and make a quick phone call. I don't know if that would count as approval from the minister.
Can I make a suggestion?
Okay. Yeah. If necessary, we can agree that the three-day rule is done away with for the purposes of this bill. And that assists us to make sure we are able to debate the bill next Thursday if the minister does not come back in time. I think that's the that's your concern, consultation with the minister in terms of the DLO rule. And I'm sure we are all in that we want to pass this bill as quickly as possible.
Unless the minister's fund, can that time make a big fall for?
Yeah, you are not.
It would help.
In the meantime, can we skip this one? We'll come back to it. 13. Agreed. 14.
Lord, we'll have it. Thank you. Okay. So, what this bill does here is it allows for payouts if an employer is not registered for PAYE or runs out of PAYE to pay back. But in this section 14, the section that allows that, called the reimbursement section, is delayed until some point where the minister decides that it should be introduced. And I don't believe that that's appropriate. I think we need to allow this reimbursement from day one. It will significantly enhance the power of the incentive and the number of jobs we can create for young people. So, Chair, if the committee agrees with me, the way to get that done, I propose, is to change 14.2 to read the entire Act comes into operation on 1 January 2014, and then simply delete 14.3. That's my proposal.
Second the proposal, Chair. Any other view on our members?
Chairperson, I think it is making sense. I would like to hear the Treasury.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourables, the reason why it is in is because we want to be able to allow it as soon as possible. However, currently it's not practically possible. Social systems does not allow for this currently. If you look at the way that this thing was designed, it is an incentive, but we need to get a way in which the incentive must reach the employer. Now, the way that it's currently structured is through the employee's tax system, which means an employee here needs to be registered. There needs to be a flow of funds from the employer to SARS, which flow of funds will then be made less so that basically the value of the incentive will be there for the employer. But the problem is that the moment that you have no flow of funds between the employer and SARS, effectively SARS needs to have a payment mechanism to people who are not currently on their register. So first put those people onto their register, and secondly have a payment mechanism in which this can happen. Now, those type of facilities and the volume is something which SARS is preparing for, but they are not yet there. So it is definitely our intention to get there as soon as possible, and that is the reason why it's in, because our other option, and that was the first instance that we had it, was to say we don't put this in, and we put this in only in a year or two's time, you know, when we know it's ready, or in 6 months' time. But the feeling was, if it's ready as soon as possible, it's like in, for example, 6 months from now, then we have to wait to put the legislation in and to amend. So what we rather did is have it in now to be switched on as soon as we can. That's the reason why you're seeing it now. The only reason is practically we can't do it yet. We would love to, we just can't yet. That's all.
Chair, you'll follow now, sorry.
Yeah. I'm concerned that this can cause delays, in as much as there could be pressures put up. We've got an election coming up next year, and if one doesn't have a specific date for that, it could be a year or it could be 2 years later. How can we get the assurance that there is a time frame within which this is going to be implemented? If SARS doesn't have the necessary systems now, it doesn't mean it can't be implemented. SARS just pays back in 6 months' time. I don't understand exactly why the system must be up and running by January. Purely because if you incur a debt to pay the employer, if you paid in 3, 4, 5 months' time, it doesn't have to be paid on the 1st of January. Or am I misunderstanding? Maybe you could assist me. But if you understand that there could be, we know that there is massive political pressure in opposing this, and we know that the minister has taken a very strong stance, as well as we in the committee. But what if that pressure translates in the run-up to the elections next year into an inordinate delay in the implementation of that, firstly? And secondly, why is this dependent on the SARS systems? Why can't there be an incurring of that ongoing debt? If they can't pay in the 1st of January, they can pay back pay, like they do often, in 6 months' time. You're running it already, and you can pay that amount again. So I'm concerned, and I would need to be reassured that this does not cause an inordinate delay. And yes, we as oversight, we as Parliament can oversight as well, so we can call the Minister to account, so maybe that's the answer.
Thank you, Chairperson. In terms of this, I can definitely give you the assurance from Treasury's point of view, we want this done as soon as possible. The only thing is our first payment, if you will be after the first year end for employers, which will be end of February in 2014, which means that your payment will have to happen soon thereafter. Now, that's a very short period of time within which to get this done. So the reason for that was basically to ensure that we've got a switch that we can control, and definitely I can give you the insurance from Treasury side, we want this in as soon as possible. I've in fact had somebody speak to me yesterday to say, this is the first thing that we work on, to make sure that this gets done. So I don't know if that gives you sufficient assurance, at least from our side. Thank you.
Yeah, I went to check the Income Tax Act, which defines how you get registered as a PAYE employer, and it's really, really easy. You simply need to be an employer to register for PAYE, so there's no block there. It sounds to me as if the block is in some kind of administrative system to process the reimbursement. I think the most convincing argument is Arnold Schwartz, that SARS operates regularly in terms of backdated payments, even if this isn't ready on that date, which is surprising considering this was one of the most efficient arms of government. I'm pretty sure they can be ready on that date. If they're slightly late, they can simply backdate the payments. And I think, Chair, the committee will probably agree that while it's reassuring to hear that there's a sense of urgency, we would at the very least need a date that we can anticipate this. And I would argue that if when we have the date, it'll probably be close enough to the implementation date to justify implementing the whole Act on 1 January, not suspending this section, not leaving those employers out of the benefits of the subsidy.
I would really be worried if the benefits to the employers are going to be procrastinated because of issues of the efficiency of the receiver. But the real of the matter is that we also need to be practical. If we put in the date now, because you see, if you read this thing, it doesn't say it was going to be something else. If it was saying it was not giving an indication of commitment to it, that would be very, very unfortunate. But it's very clear, it says the minister will then, on a day determined by the Minister of Finance, in the Gazette, that will be after considering all, the practicalities and challenges, faced by the institution. Then the minister will make that determination. And it is not saying at no stage will this thing not be done or maybe be delayed further. It's just that to be practically said, because you can imagine if we reach a time where we say it must be effective immediately linked to the date of implementation. That simply says if we reach that time, we must be ready. So if we're not ready, then it's a nightmare. And we start receiving more complaints about this. And three, we need to be very, very careful because we're experimenting here. So I will suggest that we keep this provision as it is. It's not changing anything in as far as I'm concerned. Thank you.
Honourable members, we have deliberated this matter. The spirit that we should also approach this matter is that we've got a very contact national treasury. This piece of legislation is before us, precisely because they tried very hard to push it within a very short space of time. And I feel the same spirit in terms of implementation and effective dates. I don't think there will be delays on that. So let's also give National Treasury the benefit of doubt, not even benefit. We believe that they will actually do it within the very same spirit that we push this piece of legislation before the committee and parliament. Agreed? More, the beggar.
Yeah. Chair, look, the minister is flying, so there's no way I can talk to him. He has, however, given a responsibility to assist him on this to the deputy minister, Nene, and I did have a discussion with him. Look, again, I think what he clarified is that, you know, we've, on this, we've kept it at this 3 years. We've said that it will be reviewed early enough, and the idea is it will be changed before this date on those swaps. So the idea is not that the review takes place after it ends. The idea is that it takes place in fact towards the end of 2015, early 2016, and then to extend it soon thereafter. That's been the intention. Now, I think in the first instance we would say if you could bear with us on this one, at least we could get the bill through and it gets going. If we were to delete it, well, we don't have the approval of the minister, but we obviously, you know, we're not opposed to it, because in any case Parliament can change legislation to deal with abuses or even to stop it. The Deputy Minister did say he's available on the phone, Chair, should you want to phone him. But, you know, we wouldn't oppose deletion, but we are worried that it shouldn't be at the cost of delaying the bill in any way, because as you know, the NPOP also has to consider the bill, and I think our fear is if it only goes through on Thursday, I'm not sure what their scheduling is. So it's a more practical issue, I think, on this.
Chair, I'm afraid I think this committee was substantively behind making this amendment because, frankly, it's good lawmaking and it's something we all agreed on. The practical concern is something that we need to deal with. We can't not fix a law because there's some inconvenience in the timeframe. If we believe the law needs to be fixed, that must be the first principle, and we must get that done, and then we must make it work within Parliament's program. It's not, I think, more serious legislators like Honourable Swart would agree that your first principle is to write the best law possible and then make sure that you can pass it in the time that you have. It would certainly not be appropriate to go back on our decision because of a parliamentary scheduling concern.
Let's discuss this matter fully understanding that we ourselves, as much as we don't want to badly practice this, we can find a way that this matter is ameliorated or is mitigated against, but ensure that the implementation is not delayed because of this particular amendment. But I'll make my own proposal later. Let me hear what you want to say.
No, Chair, the Minister is already going to move the technical amendment.
Yeah.
But there must be consultation. I see no reason why he can't comply with that 14-day period in a much shorter period. We are just saying, we as a committee unanimously do not like Clause 12, and it's purely the deletion of that clause. And it's for the Minister then to agree to that. He has 14 days, but he can obviously do it in 2 hours, as you've tried to contact him now. So I need to understand what the practical difficulty is with the Minister not agreeing to that. Is there something that we are missing here from Parliament's process that we're not looking at that would cause this not to go through next Thursday? I think that's the aim. We're all in agreement. We want this bill debated next Thursday, and I think that is the concern that National Treasury is expressing, that might cause a delay. If we could hear from Advocate Jenkins or anyone, if we are given that assurance, I'm not happy with Clause 12. None of us are happy with it, and it's a very straightforward position. It's not a major, major issue for us, but it's purely the process of doing that. I would not like us in some innocuous way or vague way say, no, well, because the process can't keep, we're going to agree to that sentence.
I do suggest that the same process we undertook on the linking 112, that if the committee were right, as in our recommendation, it's still going to the minister to look into that. As long as that one is going to withdraw within the House and make the gentle amendment on that one, I think she can also be comfortable but definitely we shall receive the response from the minister around the recommendation of the committee anonymously, so to delete the section 12. Thanks.
Brian?
Why? It's more of a process that needs to be clarified, because really the substance of this issue has been agreed upon. I don't know, I'm just trying to check who can help us, because is it the minister, or must we get an advice from our legal institutions here?
Thank you, Chair. The question is, when we make an proposed amendment, or when making a... this committee makes an amendment and reports to the House. That amendment must comply with the Moneyball's Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act. That act requires that such report, if we are taking a decision in terms of the act or amending a Moneyball, that report itself must comply with certain issues. All of them.
Just to help the advocate, we've already made one technical amendment. Already one, just one.
Yes.
Now, in terms of the procedure, now, we are doing the second one. This is the second one, section 12, clause 12 is the second one. Now, the question for me and to honorable members, that would be quite helpful from your side, is whether this amendment, even in terms of the money procedure and all of this, time change, is it doable within a short space of time that we're doing?
Thank you. Chair, the two amendments are different. The first one is what the minister is going to move from the floor of the House. That's not a problem. The second one, this committee needs to report on. That act requires that when you report on an amendment to an Moneyball, you must report whether it's going to affect the fiscal framework. So on that point, the minister must advise the committee. Because as I understand this proposal, there's a certain monetary value to this. And that monetary value is not a contingent liability insofar as it reflects on the time period. So it is contingent because it's experimental. We don't know how many or how much it's going to cost, how much revenue we're going to lose, or how many jobs we're going to create. Through that, the economy might grow and we get more revenue. That the Treasury will have to advise the committee. The committee will have to report on that so that the House can take an informed decision. And that's in a summary, the issues set out there in the Act. So the report must include that, and the minister needs to apply his mind to that, seeing that we're taking away that time frame. It might not have any effect, and if there's no effect on the fiscal framework or on the balance between revenue and expenditure or appropriation, then I don't see a problem. If the minister agrees, the committee can report that. In terms of what the Act requires, there's no effect on that, and the committee is happy with that. But should there be a change or should there be an effect, then the process might take longer. So that's the issue. So there's that uncertainty. And I think... for sure, if we want to consider it, can't adopt the report today. If one wants to see what the minister says, in any case, if we want to make a second substantial amendment, we can't adopt the report today. We'll have to wait for the minister to come back to say we're going to take so much time to do the research, to give proper advice on the economics around this proposed amendment of you before the committee can make that amendment and report to the House. Thanks, Chair.
Let me just ask the advocate two things. Is it possible, even if the committee, say, approves this and raises the issue, that the minister can make this amendment as a proposal to the House? So if we say, so the options are either the minister says to delete this provision, having taken into account the fiscal implications and the out-fiscal implications, or the minister, and I think it would just be easier then, so can the minister advocate the change, whether it's for the removal or to make any other change to this clause, even if it has fiscal implications, can the minister bring this up to the House?
Just to add to that, the fiscal framework, does it go up to January of 2007, or is this not outside that? Because the fiscal framework is a three-year period. So certainly we're talking about 1 January 2017, that's beyond the fiscal framework, is it not? And therefore he doesn't have to comment on the fiscal framework, which would make it much easier for him. If I understand, just help me with that, when is the fiscal framework? That's the key issue as to what research will have to be done. If it's outside of the fiscal framework, then it's a very easy decision for the minister.
Thank you.
depends where you start. You start at the budget 2013, then yes, the fiscal framework, it is on the outside. If you take it from MTPPS, I guess it will also be, well, may not be, because you've got another year added, so, yeah. No, let the advocate guide us.
That's not the answer, I understand.
Chair, the minister cannot move this amendment from the floor. That will not be possible. That is, if one wants to take a different approach to this, the committee can recommend that time frame be reviewed. The committee can recommend that the minister consider reviewing it, or the committee itself can say we will on our own review the implementation of the legislation through our oversight function, and through a committee bill or a private members bill take that away. That's one option that will allow that the committee can report today.
The NCOP process, yeah. It's got to go through the NCOP process. We're not going to be able to get this through now. And we, in our report, we strongly urge the minister in the NCOP process, and by the time it goes through the NCOP, they can recall the process.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Oliver Harris?
I need some guidance. I'm not comfortable with us not taking a decision on something like this. We can't simply hope that our colleagues in the other house do the right thing.
We report that the committee is unanimous in rejecting that clause, but in view of the time constraints and the urgency to implement the bill, we would instruct the minister, but we ask him to raise that issue with the NCOP, and likewise, National Treasury will say this is the view of the NA. I don't know how to assure that, but that is a process to the good safe part. I don't know what guarantee there is in that regard.
Chair, but I would presume if the NA does one version, the NCOP makes an amendment, it has to still come back then to the NA again. That's the normal procedure, but again, we are testing the skills of the advocate today, so...
Before advocate, because we're trying to find our way out of this. Is clause pass not a point of emphasis? Because if from the beginning, in the understanding that this act, its implementation is from the 1st of January 2014, and this act shall be or remain in operation for a period of 3 years. If you work on the basis of this time frame, it means it will cease in 2017. So basically this particular point or clause it simply emphasizes when it starts and when it ends. That's what it says. Start on the 1st of January 2014, it will end. The evaluation or the monetary whatever will happen 2 years into its operation. But because the 3 year program is going to end on the 1st of January 2017, that's what it says. So what is wrong in saying it?
Sorry, Jim. That's exactly what I said from the beginning. From the beginning, that's exactly what I have said.
So what is wrong in saying it? I don't think there's anything wrong. But that's what it says, unless I didn't do mathematics, I did functional math. So my mathematics is very weak. But common sense tells me that what is said is what the act says from the beginning. The end. So as far as I'm concerned, we can live with this without the interpretation of the law. Harris?
I'm afraid that's fundamentally different to the position that you expressed earlier.
Yeah, no, isn't that what we're discussing now?
Then my original concern is this committee has consensus that we need to delete 12 and we decide not to because of some procedural concerns. That's not good lawmaking. We have to write a correct law and then get it through how we can.
No.
We can't allow the procedural issues
to change our decision on the law.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. But I'm saying, when you read this thing again, you see that this amount of emphasis doesn't change anything.
I agree. I disagree with you. It's a subject clause. It's more than emphasis. It declares when this bill essentially ends. It allows this committee to make a decision about the next parliament and removes the bill on the 1st of January without anybody doing anything. It's much more than emphasis. It's a kind of it's a sunset clause. It's a strictly speaking a destructive clause. It destroys the bill at some point in the future.
Thank you, Chair. Can I just repeat myself from the beginning? I requested and I put a proposal which was never recognized. I said this is an instrumental, an experimental instrument, and as such, it must have a duration. That's why we must have the 2017, and us as the legislators, we will do an oversight and come out with the outcomes thereof, whether they were effective or not effective, and then take decision. Then I said at the end, then I propose that the clause remain as is, and the Chair did not recognize that. Thank you, Chair.
We're between a rock and a hard place, and I think that because of the constraints of time and the procedure that we'll have to follow, it may well be that we have to leave the clause in. But I thought that there was a general consensus in the committee, which it doesn't seem to be. And that could have been expressed in a committee report, where one could have said that the committee believes that this clause should be reconsidered or is opposed to it. But in view of the time constraints, we do not suggest that it is deleted, because that would result in a delay in the passing of this bill. But that would be my approach from my side, Chair. But I fully want this through by next Thursday, and I don't want delays with the Minister and him having to consult and consider the fiscal framework resulting in further delays.
Honourable Coroner, your wisdom.
Well, you know, Chairperson, I think that is the middle of the road way. They might be just then to put in that report that we ask the Finance Committee to do their oversight role and make sure that, you know, that it's preferably for this bill to remain. Unless he comes back and maybe his minister phoned him out. So let's wait 10 seconds.
The fact that we are now hoping, I think most of the members are hoping that the DDG comes back in with a sign that the minister is okay with this change, which is a change that you actually proposed from the chair, which the whip supported, which there's substantive support in the committee, maybe not consensus, but it's substantive support, shows that it's the right thing to do. And I think we must do it. That's all. We have to write the best law possible, and then we worry about the procedure. Everybody wants this bill through, but let's write the bill properly, and then we make it work. We can't compromise on the text because we're worried about some parliamentary process.
Thanks, Chair. I think we're here because of the text. All of us who agree in Chair, in spirit, that look, we wouldn't be able to deal with the youth unemployment over a period of 4 years. And that's the understanding that we have. I mean, we share that sentiment. However, Chair, as I said, now when we apply our mind, just saying that now we are debating. When we apply your mind, you can see that practically it's a project that has got the time frame where it starts and where it ends. It's got an impact on fiscal, Chair. So I'm proposing, if it will make us feel better, Chair, that as much as it says that the thing is going to come to an end on the 2018, we must just put emphasis somewhere around the issue of the 2-year review one. so that the legislators at that time can still take the bill forward. Thanks.
Not yet, Chair.
Honourable members, I think we leave, I propose that we leave close to us as is. And the fact that this program is going to be reviewed in 2 years' time, the committee has an opportunity to participate. And at that moment, if there's a need to look at this, we'll then deal with that particular matter. Yeah, it will be in the report. Agreed?
I have to again bring us back to
the original what?
The original proposal which I moved probably an hour ago now, that we delete.
Okay. Any support for that? Okay. Any defending view? Can I say? Okay. You have it, but we'll still require this particular matter. Honourable members, let me come to the end.
Okay, sorry. The last proposal we dealt with before on section 14, the question wasn't put to the committee.
Which one?
My proposal that we delete 14.3 and change 14.2.
14.3.
About when the sections of the Act come into being, it wasn't put to the committee, the proposal under section 14. We've dealt with it already, but it just wasn't put.
I thought we had dealt with that.
No.
Okay. Put it forward.
So my proposal, just to remind members, is to delete 14.3 and amend 14.2 to read the entire Act coming into operation on 1 January 2014.
No. That's your proposal. Can we hear National Treasury? Okay. So what is the position of that of the committee? Can I just test? Defending view on the proposal?
I'm not following this approach. What are we defending or agreeing on?
Can you just clarify that?
We left section 12, the proposal, because we were waiting to hear from the minister. We moved on to section 14, where I proposed that the entire bill kicks in at the same time, which would then require SARS to have this payout mechanism. We then had a debate about whether they would be able to do that or not. The only problem is we didn't vote on the proposal, my proposal, that we amend section 14. So we just didn't put the question at all. So I'm just saying that we need to run through that process now.
You say it's done. Judith, the last one. It's done.
If you could just note the opposition of it or the objection of it.
All right, fine. Good. Thank you. Can I therefore put it before this committee with the following, with the amendments that we have put in? And in a report, we'll then put in this other part, section 12. That, where is that? No. I'm trying to write, I'm trying to chair the meeting. Yeah. Section 12. Honorable members, let me start with the following. That the committee notes the incorrect reference to section 22.1 of the Refugees Act 1998 in line 44 of page 5. The committee recommends to the Minister of Finance to propose a technical correction in terms of section 14 of the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, number 1 of 2009. And this is the technical amendment that we have agreed on. Act number 10. Why do you write Act number 9? Okay. 10 of 2009. Now, this is the first amendment, in fact the technical amendment that we've agreed on. I also then want to put it before the committee with this amendment. At the Standing Committee of Finance, having considered and examined the Employment Tax Incentive Bill, B46/2013, National Assembly, Section 77, referred to it, and as classified by the JCM as money bill, reports that it has agreed to the bill. Agreed? Yeah. Advocate?
Apologies, Chair, it is Act Number 9. My apologies.
Yeah. I was right. You were right. Act Number 9. All right. Agreed? Thank you. Honourable Harris?
Chair, can I request the committee report contains a minority report that expresses the areas where there wasn't consent?
Okay. All right.
I'm saying no problem.
Okay. Honourable members, thank you very much. At least the spirit that we normally have is also prevailing. Let's work like this until we have to 2 weeks. We'll campaign afterwards. I don't know if you have got rally voices, but you'll meet me out there. Thank you very much for my...